The Healthy Alabama podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama, a program that enrolls Alabamians in the health insurance marketplace. Navigators provide free local in-person support to all applicants. Enroll Alabama, 256-432-7494, 256-432-7494.
Welcome to this special edition of the Healthy Alabama podcast, sponsored by Enroll Alabama and produced in partnership with Oakwood University Radio. Praise 90.1 FM, WJOU. I'm David Person. This episode is the conclusion of my interview with Dr. David Williams of Harvard University, conducted before a live audience on February the 18th, 2018, in the Peters Media Center on the Oakwood University campus.
The work you've been doing clearly has veracity, as you've just established. So I wonder, what kind of success do you think you're having in affecting the creation of public policy and legislation? Again, I'm referencing the current political climate we're in, where it seems to me that there is an aversion to this kind of conversation and to those kinds of facts.
So you're right, and maybe we should come back to the current political climate. I've written a little bit about it, and I'm planning to do some research on the effects of the current political climate on health. But let me answer your question specifically. One of the things that I've been very thankful for is that I have had a number of opportunities to play a role in policymaking circles in the U.S. There has been a shift over time, even on the part of many large federal agencies, to take seriously the emergent evidence that race matters first, and that racism matters second. And within the National Institutes of Health, for example, which is a large federal agency that allocates over $30 billion a year to health-related research in the U.S., there have been specific calls for papers to study racism and the way it affects health, and there have been a number of initiatives along those lines. I think the same is true within the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, so that it is seeping into the federal agencies. It is seeping into, I've had students, one of my students who worked at the Department of Housing and urban development, for example, on working on policies of equity to improve equity in housing. We now have an Adventist who heads that agency. Even though he's an Adventist, I'm troubled by what's happening within that agency.
You're talking about
right
Dr.
now.
Ben Carson?
I'm talking about Dr. Ben Carson, who I no longer admit to people that I knew him. Because it's the truth. I know I'm on tape, but I run into people who know him. I don't say anything. 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I would have said, oh, that's my friend, you know, but I don't say anything. This is the point I'm making. Change is slow, and change is incremental. There is increasing awareness. There is progress that is being made. But I would also be quick to say these issues are contested. And we are in a particular moment in U.S. history where I think there's less openness to some topics than others. On the other hand, there are things that are happening within the bureaucracy, by the career professionals that are there, irrespective of who's at the top. But I would say we are in a hostile environment, to say the least, that may slow down progress that we could have made or that we were making. I think we have to wait to see how the dust settles and see where things actually are at the end of the day. But that we are in a contested and difficult environment, without a doubt. I have been very concerned, and I wrote a paper published in the top medical journal in the United States, the New England Journal of Medicine, about the potential impact of the Trump candidacy and election on the health of the American population. And I wasn't just drawing out of thin air. I was drawing on a study done by the Southern Poverty Law Center, that interviewed more than 2,000 K-12 teachers in the United States. And this report was published before the election, during the campaign. And 60% of those teachers reported that as a result of the presidential campaign, more of their students were stressed out and fearful and worried as what might happen as a result of the election. A lot of minority students, a lot of immigrant students, a lot of students who were perceived as Muslim, whether they were Muslim or not. That report also indicated that most of these teachers also reported that a number of some of their other students were emboldened to attack, to say hostile things, some of their fellow classmates. And there were qualitative descriptions of some of these things. And when you read the qualitative descriptions some of the teachers gave, it could break your heart. There was a kindergarten teacher in North Carolina who talked about one of a kindergarten's Latino students who came to school every day and would ask his teacher, "Is the wall here yet?" Because his classmates in kindergarten had told him, "Trump is going to build a wall and you're going to be stuck behind it and you will not be able to get to school." So that little five-year-old is coming to school with all of this anxiety of, "Is the wall here yet?" So we know all of this stuff. Not only that, the Southern Poverty Law Center kept a record of what happened in the wake of the election. And what they found, and they're looking at the reports that people are given, that in the wake of the election, there were increasing reports of people, particularly minorities, immigrants, reporting hostile attacks. These attacks were most common in K-12 schools. So our elementary and high schools were the number one place in America where people were being attacked based on their ethnicity or immigrant status. And many of the attacks said, explicitly linked it to the election of Donald Trump, that this is Trump's country now. I have one of my Latino students at Harvard who came to me, and right on the Harvard campus 2 days after the election, two Puerto Rican Latino students at Harvard. They're from Puerto Rico. They're American citizens. But two men rushed up to them and told them they need to go back to their country. This is Trump's country now. So, I mean, these incidents were occurring. And so we need to think of what is happening to a generation of vulnerable young children. And I made a specific call for pediatricians and for other health professionals who work with kids to work with local school boards and local principals to equip them with how do you respond, first of all, to trying to create a climate that will affirm and value everyone, the dignity of every child of humanity, number one. But then how do we find ways to effectively reach out to those who are scared, who are fearful, who are anxious about what is happening and where the nation is going? The American Psychological Association did a study in January of last year, right after the inauguration, and found that a high proportion of all Americans report that the election result has been a source of stress. Even 25% of Republicans reported the result of the election as a source of stress. And the levels were higher among African Americans, among Latinos, than it was among whites. But even among whites, it was over 40% of whites reporting that. So the question is, we know, I study stress and its impacts on health. What are the health consequences of the stress? And there's a constant drumbeat. I have one of my students. She's a doctoral student at Harvard. She's an activist. She was responding every day to every new thing that the president might have said or someone in his administration might have said. And I saw her. She was a teaching fellow for me at one class. And I said, "How are you doing?" She says, "Professor Williams, I'm so exhausted." She can't keep up, you know, because every single day in the early days, there was something else they were organizing the group about. And I said, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to wear you out. You got to pick your battles well. You can't fight every single one. You have to choose which ones you fight and be strategic and take care of yourself. You know, so the question is, what's the tool? And so my hope is, I'm still waiting to get funding to do this. One of the challenges is a major funder of most of my research has been the federal government or the National Institutes of Health. I don't think they will fund a study looking at the health impact of the election. So I think if someone tried to fund it, they might lose their job.
Right.
So right. I have to look at outside of the federal government. I've identified a source of data that we could look at, a large healthcare system that will allow us to work with their researchers. And this large healthcare system has millions of patients in their database, and they have real time, so I could pick any date, and they could tell me every person who came, what was their prescription, what was their presenting problem. We could look to see if there's been an increase in cardiovascular events. We could look to see if there's an increase in prescription for depression, for anxiety, for sleep problems. We could look if there's an increase in anxiety attacks and so forth. So we are planning to do this study. I am just waiting to get the financial resources to document it. And I've put a great team of researchers together. One researcher at Harvard who has been studying the impact of large events, the impact of earthquakes. There's even studies that show that we Americans, there should be a study in the U.S. on this. I don't think there has been. If your team loses the Super Bowl, what are the consequences for health? There have been studies. Mm. No, there have been studies that find increase in cardiovascular events in the country that lost the World Cup. In the World Cup final, the country among men, in the country that lost the World Cup, there's an increase in cardiovascular events. Wow. So then this guy has been doing this kind of work. So I've got a great team. We've got great ideas. I have a potential funding source. We've got data we have access to. And what's beautiful about the data we get access to, this large healthcare system, we can go back. So we can look at what happened in the January of Trump's election and look at what happens in January of the prior 4 years.
Sure.
And even Obama's election, so that we can look to see if there are secular trends, if there's something else that's driving it. So right. I am very interested in that topic, and I would say stay tuned and pray that all works out and me getting the money so we can be able to do the study.
I have a question that will take us in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
But before I ask you that, I do feel compelled to share this with you. There's a minister here in this community of another faith who was telling me, a Caucasian, who was telling me after the election of Trump that she and other clergy, white clergy, were receiving distressed phone calls from parishioners and others, people who were not just distressed, but some of whom were talking about committing suicide. And I thought that was a very telling, and for me it was very unexpected to hear. And she also made the comment to me that she said, I'm sure that in your community you're not going through that because you guys are used to dealing with far worse. And, of course, you know, slavery, Jim Crow, segregation, lynching, you know, the use of rapes, you know, against black women in the Jim Crow era. She's right. We are used to worse. But I just thought that was very telling, that it wasn't, as you're saying, we weren't the only community distressed.
Yes.
With the election of Trump.
That is absolutely true.
Now, you've talked a lot about race, and you've done a lot of research regarding race and racism and its impact on health and health care. Let's also talk about something else, and that is socioeconomic status. That seems to be an important variable also in your research. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Race is a powerful driver of inequalities in health. What most people do not realize is that the gaps in health by socioeconomic status, income or education, in the United States for most health outcomes are larger than the gaps in health by race. Let me state that a different way. The gap in health between poor whites and middle-class whites is bigger than the black-white gap. And the gap in health between poor African-Americans and middle-class African-Americans is bigger than the black-white gap. That's true for most health outcomes in national data for the U.S. At the same time, for 100 years, the federal government routinely reports data on health. And they routinely report data on race, on racial differences in health. They seldom report data on socioeconomic status differences in health. And even less frequently do they report data on race and socioeconomic status together. And I would want to say to you, it's not that they don't know better. I was appointed by the first Bush administration to the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics. That is a congressionally mandated advisory committee that maintains oversight on all federal health data collected by the government and is supposed to advise the Secretary of Health and Human Services on improving the quality of data being collected. I served on that committee. I chaired its subcommittee on minority and special populations. It's a 4-year appointment. And we have made a number of recommendations on the collection of data on race and the reporting of data on race. And one of our recommendations has been that you should routinely report data by race and income or education together, because the pattern changes. It sheds more light on what the underlying factors are. There is an annual publication by the federal government called Health United States. It's, if you ever want to know everything you wanted to know about health in America and more, it's a 500-page document. It's available online. Just Google Health United States. 2016 would be the most recent report. And there's a treasure trove of data on health in America that you could find. What we have recommended is that instead of only reporting data on race, report data on race and socioeconomic status together. If you look at Health United States today, it's 500 pages. There are probably 3 tables in there that do that. Now, that's progress because none did it before. But there are 3 tables that do it. One of the things I have found working with large federal bureaucracies is that they are very slow to change. And they'll tell you it changes their data systems, it changes the continuity of their data. They like to look at trends over time. When we do something differently, we don't do it. They're just very resistant to change, just like many churches, right? There was a scholar wrote a book about the church, and he called the 7 last words of the church, "We've never done it that way before." You know, so anytime you bring up a new idea, it's rejected because we didn't do it that way before. So I think the same thing you run into federal. So I think one of the things we need to do much more routinely is to report data by race and socioeconomic status together. Because when you do that, you find it's not either or. That race matters, that socioeconomic status matters, and that race matters even after you've taken socioeconomic status into account. So that at every level of income and education, blacks still have worse health, which allows us to say, as we think of improving the health of America, and remember, all Americans need to be doing better in terms of health, not just black folk, all Americans, even the best of whites, studies show, are not achieving a level of health as their counterparts in Western European countries. So all of us could be doing better in terms of health. And so, but we need to think of strategies that would help us to improve the health of everyone and addresses socioeconomic inequalities. But we also have to think of what would be the strategies that would address the added burden of race, that addresses racial ethnic inequalities that persist even after we've taken socioeconomic status into account. The one last point I'd say about socioeconomic status, and just in terms of how powerful it is, socioeconomic status matters for health, not just in the U.S., but in virtually every country of the world where we have data. People of higher income, higher education, higher occupational status do better in health than persons who are not as well off socioeconomically as they are. And that's true throughout Western Europe, even in countries with a good healthcare system. It's true in developing nations. It's true globally.
To illustrate what you just talked about in terms of this sort of complicated relationship between race, racism, and socioeconomic status and health, Can you tell, for those who have not seen your TED Talk, can you tell the story of Clyde Murphy and Yale?
Sure. Clyde Murphy was a graduate of Yale University. He was one of those early classes of African-American students who had made it into Yale. Clyde Murphy was a success. After Yale, he went to Columbia, got a law degree, was a very successful professional, litigated, was a civil rights attorney, had a good family life, had two kids. On every dimension of professional and personal success, Clyde Murphy had done well. But Clyde Murphy and many other members of his class died prematurely. And the researchers did a study looking at all of the students who had graduated from that Yale class of 1970 and found that the death rate among the black Yale graduates was 3 times higher than that of white Yale graduates. So documenting that he went to Yale compared to his white counterparts, yet systematically the death rate was higher for blacks who graduated from Yale than from whites who graduated from Yale the very same year. Let me give you another example. It was not in my TED Talk, but it's another example I talk about. I call it, when I talk about it, Meharry versus Johns Hopkins. There was a study done of medical students graduating from Meharry Medical College in the early 1960s, and all black, and white medical students graduated from Johns Hopkins exactly about the same time. And they followed them for 25 years. Now they are all physicians, trained in the U.S., working in the U.S. You have exquisitely controlled on social class. So you would expect to find no racial differences in health. Instead, what the study found, that the black physicians had twice the rate of hypertension and diabetes than the white physicians did. And that the black physicians had a much higher rate of heart disease and a very much even higher rate of what's called case fatality, which means if they got the problem, they're much more likely to have died of it. So it's the kind of evidence that indicates even when you have made it socioeconomically, there is this black tax that you're paying that is having a consequence on your physiological functioning and the quality of life and your exposure to disease. Now, we know there are several factors that drive that. One of the factors that we haven't paid a lot of attention to, and there's increasing scientific research, is that our health is affected not only by our current social circumstances, but by what we've been exposed to over our entire life course. So if you look at the African-American medical school graduates in the early 1960s compared to the white graduates, they're more likely to have been born poor. They're more likely to have been born low birth weight. They're more likely to have experienced deficits in access to quality medical care, good nutrition, while they were growing up. They're more likely to have experienced chronic poverty in their homes while you're growing up. And our bodies keep a record of all of our exposures. And what happens early in life shapes what happens later in life. And there's research now that shows not only what happens to you in your mother's womb. So, for example, there's a researcher in the UK, Barker. It's called the Barker hypothesis after him, that he was able to claim, and empirical evidence supported it, that he can predict who will be at risk of heart disease in their 50s, when they're in their 40s and 50s, by looking at whether they experience delayed intrauterine growth during their mother's womb. And now there's research on what is called preconception stress. We're not looking at what happened to your mother during pregnancy. We are looking at the stress in the life of your mother the year before she became pregnant. And there's research now. The earliest studies were out of Sweden that shown if your mother had high stress the year before she got pregnant, and this is a large national sample data accumulated over multiple years, the babies of mothers who had high stress the year before they became pregnant had a 50% increased risk of dying before their first birthday.
Wow.
That's correct. So what is not just, it is not just what happens to you during your life course or during your mother's womb, what happened in the lives of your parents even before you were conceived. You are gaining life from them. You are the intergenerational transmission of social adversity is one of the hottest areas of research in the study of health disparities. And I would say we believe there is, we just beginning to apply this to race, so I can't talk about a good, strong study documenting it about race, although there are scholars speculating about it. But we've got good evidence. There's a researcher in New York City called Yehuda, who's been studying Holocaust survivors. And she's been able to document the intergenerational transfer of an epigenetic effect so that people who went through the Holocaust have an epigenetic change, which is a change in their genes that puts them at greater risk for PTSD that was linked to the environmental exposure of the Holocaust. She's finding that epigenetic change present in their children. So it goes, the parents are given this epigenetic change to their children, and their children are also at higher risk for PTSD. So it's one evidence. There's also work among Native Americans that is looking at what they call historical trauma. And the questions that are being asked in this research, you ask Native Americans how often you think about what has happened to your ancestors in the past in the U.S., or how often do things happen in your life that reminds you about the way your ancestors were exploited. And studies are finding that high levels of historical trauma predicts poorer physical and mental health. So we are now understanding the complexity of the factors that drive health. Certainly what's happening to you now and what's happened to you over your life course, but we are now even looking back further, and the further we look, by the way, this should not surprise Christians, right? Doesn't the Bible say God visits the iniquities of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation? Some of us are struggling with problems linked to who our great-grandparents were. And so the science is catching up with some insights from the scripture.
How about that? We've got some folks with some questions, I believe, it looks like. Go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Dr. Williams. First and foremost, just thank you for coming out and just sharing great information, not only during chapel, but just right now. My name is Rayvon Pittman. I'm a psychology major. My question is, I know that you've studied how discrimination and racism from other cultures has impacted the black community and people of the African diaspora. However, how does discrimination, such as colorism, and other factors play a part when it's members within our own community that are doing these things?
Great question. Thank you.
That is a really good question. I would say in the early research on discrimination, we did not pay any attention to the perpetrator. Who is the person inflicting the discrimination on you? And I would still say most of the research does not ask questions about who has done it. There's been just a few studies, very few, that have looked at who the perpetrator is. And one study I remember well from a colleague at UCLA that asked African Americans about when they experienced discrimination, who was the person and what's the racial makeup of the person. And she found something interesting. Her measure of outcome was mental health. And she found among African Americans, when they were discriminated against, if the perpetrator was also African-American, the effect on mental health was greater. The negative effect on mental health was greater than if the perpetrator was white.
Wow.
And if you stop and think about it, it makes sense. Because one of the things we know about stress in general, One of the things that determines how impactful stress is on you is how unexpected it is. So something that comes out of the blue, something that's a surprise, that's stressful, is more likely to affect you than if you knew this was coming, you just didn't know exactly when. And so there's a sense in which when a white person has discriminated against you, as bad as that is, you understand, you know this happens, that's part of, your parents socialized you to know that these things happen in
it's
life.
It's the American experience.
But it's the American experience. But when your brother or sister that you were counting on to have your back treated you unfairly, it hurts more. This is a joke, but it's relevant. It makes me think about it. When I went to Yale, there was an African-American, I was in the Department of Sociology, there was an African-American gentleman in the Department of Sociology at Yale, and he went out of his way to recruit me. He really wanted, I had an offer from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for example. He went out of his way to encourage me to come, including offering to fly me to New York City for a weekend to show me what, and he, all expenses paid, he was going to pay it personally. And he was just such a great guy. And I remember talking with him one day, and he shared with me experiences of how much jealousy there often is in academia, even from your own people. And I have found what he said to be true myself. And he was just talking about how some other black colleagues at Yale had treated him. That he said to me something I've never forgotten. He said, David, when the revolution comes, there's some black people on campus I'm shooting first.
That's funny.
It is funny, but it's a profound truth it captures.
Let me just follow up on something that the young man, embedded in the question the young man raised. He used the term colorism. So
yes,
it seems to me that this is...
I didn't answer that aspect
right,
of it. Yes.
This is particularly significant because some of the... I think he's alluding to the fact that some of the bad behavior or discriminatory behavior that comes from other black people is specifically due to the ingrained skin prejudices we have.
Yes.
In our community.
I'm glad you came back to that because I apologize. I forgot to that aspect of the question. I would encourage you, if you are interested in this, to look up the research of a scholar at the University of Chicago by the name of Monk, M-O-N-K, Monk. He is writing, has published multiple papers on skin color stratification in the black community. They are recent papers. He's also doing the same in Brazil. And what Monk... Let me put it this way. Let me go back to the National Study of Black Americans, 1979-80, the first nationally representative study of the black population in the United States. And a paper by Cedric Herron and Verna Keith showed that in the African-American community... parental occupational status and income and education is a predictor of the next generation's educational, occupational, and income status. However, they also found that skin color was a stronger predictor, especially for women, of adult income and occupational status than was parental economic background. If a woman is lighter complexioned, she is more likely to get a higher paying job and a higher, more prestigious job. And that relationship was stronger than her parents' economic background.
Wow.
So there has been a history of that. And what Monks has done recently, these are papers all in the last 3 or 4 years, he is using the National Survey of American Life, an update of the National Study of Black Americans, where we have, I was one of the scholars that developed that survey instrument. We included the measure that was used in 79-80, where we have interviewers to report the shade of skin color of the respondent from very light to very dark. And he is using that to predict outcomes and finding, yes, within the black community, your skin tone matters. And the effect tends to be stronger for women than for men.
Thanks for joining us for parts 1 and 2 of my interview with Dr. David Williams of Harvard University. Special thanks to Dr. Leslie Pollard, president of Oakwood University, Dr. Colwick Wilson, provost, and Ken Dixon, director of integrated marketing and public relations, for their support. Special thanks also to Damian Malone, WJOU's assistant general manager, for his post-production wizardry, and to Brittany Matthews and Cherish Charles of the provost's office. They kept the trains running on time and with efficiency. The Healthy Alabama podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama and produced in partnership with Oakwood University Radio, Praise 90.1 FM, WJOU. Our theme music was produced by DJ Bailey. You can stream the podcast at WJOU.org or on Stitcher, iTunes, or Google Play. I'm David Person. Until next time, be healthy.
The Healthy Alabama podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama, a program that enrolls Alabamians in the health insurance marketplace. Navigators provide free local in-person support to all applicants. Enroll Alabama, 256-432-7494, 256-432-7494.